David O'Hara grew up in the Catskill Mountains of New York, home to some of the most famous trout fishing streams in the world. Today, he's a philosophy professor living in Sioux Falls. He's teaching at Augustana College. But when he gets the chance, he goes back to fish the familiar streams of his youth. Along with his fishing friend, Matthew Dickerson, who teaches at Middlebury College in Vermont, O'Hara writes about the joy of fishing and the wonder of nature and its impact on all facets of life in the new book, Downstream: Reflections on Brook Trout, Fly Fishing, and the Waters of Appalachia. The two write about fishing in streams from Maine down to Tennessee. David O'Hara joins us from our studios at the University of Sioux Falls. And Dave, thanks for joining us on Dakota Midday.
Thanks, Carl. It's great to be here.
Well, when did you and your friend Matthew Dickerson first have the idea to put together this book?
Well, we've been fishing together since the early 90s or even the late 80s. And I think it was just a couple of years ago we realized that this is a great way to spend time together. We used to live together in Vermont. We would go out and hang out in streams for hours at a time, and now we live so far away. We thought, let's go back and explore these streams that we grew up in and the rest of the rivers of the Appalachians that we don't know. So,
what in particular was it you were trying to explore?
You know, more than anything, it's probably the places themselves. You know, you get this impression. Let me talk about South Dakota just for a moment.
Yes,
because this will be familiar. I think you if you live in South Dakota and you talk to people who don't live here, they'll describe it as flyover country. Or if their experience of South Dakota is driving on I-90, they've experienced it at 75 miles an hour. They haven't stopped to see it. But you know, if you walk through the prairie here, the way say a pheasant hunter does, or a hiker, or a farmer, rancher, if you take the time to have your feet on the ground, you get to know the place in a really different way. And the same is true of rivers and streams. I just love to walk in streams. They're full of surprising things. You know, the time you take a step and you think you're about to step on a rock and it turns out to be a turtle. Yeah. You know, the beaver that splashes in front of you, the deer that crashes through the woods just beside you, the mink that swims in the river. So, you know, the title of the book, the subtitle is Reflections on Brook Trout. The brook trout are, if you will, the lure that the mountains use to draw me back into the rivers, but there was so much more than the brook trout that I was looking for.
You write, you mentioned just getting to know the places that you're at, and one of the anecdotes that you write about is, you know, when you were a kid, what was it, about sixth grade, you and a friend, it was recess time, and you just went off and started exploring a nearby stream.
Yeah, a friend of mine who read the book said, and that sounded like a pretty innocent exploration. it was Bo Keppen and I, and it was not exactly innocent. We knew exactly what we were doing and evading the playground monitors, but we just kind of had the sense that this was special time in a special place, and we were going to steal the time back, even though we weren't supposed to. Yeah, we dashed off into the woods at the edge of our playground, and we hung out in the Sawkill Creek that goes right by our school, Zena Elementary School in Woodstock, New York. And we spent probably about an hour there just lying on big flat rocks and poking at salamanders and catching crayfish, watching snakes in the river. And after about an hour, we kind of had that nagging feeling like we might be in trouble now. Yeah. We got back in, and our sixth grade teacher looked at us, and then he called the principal and told him to call off the search, and that was when we really started to get panicky. Yeah, worth it, though. Totally worth it.
Totally worth it, and it makes a great anecdote. Now, this experience and this interest in the streams and fly fishing, this was something that you learned from your father?
Yeah. So my dad, when he grew up, his father was off fighting the Second World War in the Pacific, and his Uncle Charlie took him under his wing. And Uncle Charlie was a man of the woods, a man who knew how to do things with his hands and build things and fix things. And he taught Dad to fish. And Dad gave me a lot of great gifts. One of the great gifts that he gave me was just a love of the outdoors and sort of a sense of attentiveness to it and patience to see what it wants to reveal. And when I was in high school, he gave me an old bamboo fly rod that he had bought at an auction, and neither of us knew how to fly fish, so I took it out there and I flogged the water with it for a while and had a great time. And eventually I met Matt Dickerson, and he taught me a lot more about fly fishing, and we've been doing it together ever since.
How would you describe fly fishing and what it takes to be a good fly fisherman?
Well, you know, being a good fly fisherman, it's a little bit like what it took to get my PhD. More perseverance than intelligence. you just have to be willing to persist through a lot of failure. The idea of fly fishing is that instead of casting some heavy bait or a heavy lure or something, what you're casting is the weight of the line. It's more like throwing a whip than like than tossing a heavy sinker. And what you're trying to do is imitate the thing that the fish are already looking at. So you have to know something about what the fish are like and what the fish would be eating at this time of day, at this time of year. Often when Matt and I go out to a stream, the first thing we do is just sit and we look at the river and watch. What are the bugs that are on the surface? What are the bugs that are flying over the river right now? You know, these bugs, when they're flying in the air, are often just a distraction that we kind of tune out, like static on the radio. When you're fly fishing, the bugs are the thing that you want to pay attention to, because they're like a sign of what's going on underneath the water. So you find an imitation of what's in the air. You have to know something about entomology, about the life cycle of the various kinds of insects and other invertebrates that live in the water, and then you try to present it in such a way that the fish will believe that it's actually a real food. I think it's funny that as a philosophy professor, I spend a lot of my time trying to undeceive people and trying to deceive trout. Yeah.
You write that fishing for trout requires you to see the world as trout see it, and that is essentially what you're doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, we'll even put on a snorkel and go underwater just to try to experience the world as the trout see it. Matt taught me this when he had kids a couple of years before I did, and I remember him coming over to play with my kids when they were little, and the first thing he did was he got down on his hands and knees. And I said, you know, so why are you doing that? And he said, because I want to see the world the way that your kids see it, rather than asking them to look up at my world. And fly fishing is a lot like that, too. You want to try to see the world the way that the fish see it. Sometimes I'll stick a GoPro camera underwater in a stream and just watch it. And it's amazing how different a stream looks like. It looks underwater. Trout will hide behind a log or a rock in the still water, letting the fast water go by beside them. So they don't actually see much that's upstream of them. They see what's over top of them, and they see what's to their left and to their right. And it's sort of like a floating buffet line. And they'll just hang in that still water where they don't have to work hard. And then they'll dash into the fast water as something goes by to grab it.
How common is it for fly fishermen to do that amount of research to get to know the world of the trout before they even start throwing a line?
It's pretty common, actually. Yeah. I think that a lot of the people who do fly fishing regularly will recognize that in this book. It sounds tedious at first if I tell you got to learn the difference between a mayfly and a caddisfly, or learn what a helgramite is like, or something like that. You know, some people might say, I'm not really interested in bugs. But, you know, you take a kid out into a stream and say, hey, turn over that rock. And they pick up the rock and they look at the bottom of it and say, what do you see? That's really different than from trying to teach them the lessons of formal entomology as they would learn it in a textbook. And it can be the gateway by which they then say, now I want to study entomology. So you get fly fishermen who will go out and they'll buy books on entomology, and they'll buy books on stream ecology. You know, they'll buy books on riparian ecology, on fish, you know, learning all kinds of things. For many of us, it's kind of like what Thoreau says, you know, that by one bait or another, nature allures us into her recesses, but that it's not ultimately the fish that we're going out there for. I think sometimes people mistake hunting for killing and fishing for killing. And one of the things that I want to emphasize to my students, for instance, when I teach philosophical ecology at Augustana, is that hunting is hunting. It's looking. It's searching. Sometimes that involves killing, and same with fishing. Sometimes that involves killing, but more than anything, it's paying attention.
You write in the book Downstream, in one of your essays, that your son was 10 years old at the time, and he asked that question. You know, why were you fishing when you didn't need to fish for food? And you found that a very difficult question to answer, even now, when you're writing about it. Why is that such a difficult question?
Well, it's a difficult question because I'm aware of the fact that when I catch a fish, I'm causing it distress. You know, it's hard to know what exactly the fish's experience is like, but, you know, does it feel pain? Does it not feel pain? But what I'm definitely aware of is it doesn't want to be on my hook, and I'm, you know, I've deceived it and I've caused it to experience something that it doesn't want to experience. You know, this it's the same as, you know, if you eat bacon for breakfast, you can eat the bacon and not think about the experience of the animal. But if you cause yourself to think about what the animal went through in its life, and especially at the moment of its death, you might start to feel a little bit less excited about eating the bacon. So, you know, for I think anyone who spends a lot of time with nature, you start to feel a certain sympathy with the animals and even the insects sometimes that live out there, and you feel a little bad about the ways that we interfere with their lives, even just driving and hitting small animals. A bird flew into my car the other day and hit it while I was on the interstate, and you know, you just, there's nothing I could have done about it, but you still feel badly at the loss. At the same time, fishing is sometimes the only way that I can really connect with what's going on under the water. And there's so much going on under the water, it's just too fascinating not to. And not only too fascinating not to connect to it, what's going on under the water affects me. You know, what happens in these high mountain streams in the Appalachians, as the title of my book suggests, affects everybody downstream. Matt and I often run into kayakers, and sometimes the kayakers will treat us as though what they're doing is superior to what we're doing because they're not killing anything. And when we have the opportunity to, we remind them that they can't tell the difference between clean water and dirty water or polluted water, because sometimes the most polluted water looks the clearest. If it's got a lot of acid in it, for instance, if there's a chemical imbalance in the water that's killed all the biomass in it, it'll look as clean as glass. You know, healthy water has often got a little bit of a little murk to it. But the kayakers don't know this because they live with a different kind of intimacy. There's nothing wrong with what they do. But I find, at any rate for me, that fishing is something that helps me to recognize the ways that my life and the lives of the fish and the insects are all connected.
You're listening to Dakota Midday on South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and my guest is David O'Hara. He teaches philosophy at Augustana College in Sioux Falls. He and his friend Matthew Dickerson have a new book called Downstream, Reflections on Brook Trout, Fly Fishing, and the Waters of Appalachia. And Dave, you're talking about the pollution and water, and one of the things that you write in regards to brook trout is they're canary in a coal mine. And as a fisherman, you can see how things are changing.
That's right. Yeah, they're a very fragile species. We think of them as an indicator species of the health of a watershed. If the water temperature increases, for instance, brook trout are among the first to die because they need an awful lot of oxygen. The warmer the water, the lower the saturated oxygen. If the water becomes very acid, it's harder for the insects that they feed on to grow and to develop, and the trout will suffer very quickly that way as well. Yeah, you know, you pay attention to any one feature of an ecosystem, and it will wind up connecting you to all of the other features in the ecosystem. So for me, the brook trout, they're really a beautiful fish. As I said, they're the lure that the rivers use to draw me in.
Now, in writing about the pollution, the environmental changes, that's part of the book, and early on, I think it is the first essay, and this is one written by Matt Dickerson, your friend, and this is about the Androscoggin River in Maine. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
You are, yeah.
And this is his essay, but it's about the two of you are both fishing in this river, and this is...
Right.
This is one of the stories that I guess is more hopeful, in that we're able to recover these rivers and get them back to the way they were and have the trout thrive again.
Yeah, that's right. It's amazing how quickly we can hurt a river, but it's also amazing how quickly rivers can recover if we give them the right conditions. You know, laws like the Clean Water Act and... you know, the work of the EPA have, I know that they're controversial at times, but it's amazing just how much they can set a few rules that will very quickly clean up a river. In the case of the Androscoggin in Maine, people were dumping sewage directly into it, and there were some timber mills and paper mills that were dumping the effluent of the paper-making process into the river, and it killed the entire river. There was very little living in it. They cut off those point sources of pollution. They started enforcing some small setbacks. You know, if you just let the grass and the trees grow for a few yards along the edge of any river, that will catch much of the pollution, much of the organic pollution that would have gone into the river. And the Androscoggin is now one of the great fishing rivers in the country. Unfortunately, there are some times when, for instance, in the Connecticut River that runs between Vermont and New Hampshire, we kill off a species, the Atlantic salmon that used to have huge runs in there. We dammed it, and the salmon couldn't run upriver to their natal reds. They couldn't go up and lay their eggs. And even though we've built fish ladders for them, the Atlantic salmon have never really come back to that river again.
You've had this lifelong passion for the trout streams and fly fishing. I'm wondering how that has then affected the other parts of your life, whether it's raising a family, whether it's teaching philosophy at Augustana College, and just your day-to-day existence. I mean, having this passion must infect, I don't know if that's the right word, but must affect every part of your being in your existence.
I suppose you could think of my fly fishing not as a sport so much as a symptom of a whole life. Aristotle says that the love of wisdom begins in wonder, and fly fishing, brook trout, time spent in streams, and the sixth grade with Bo Kepin, all these things have been things that provoke wonder for me. There's an American philosopher who lived earlier in the 20th century who was asked by a German philosopher, Henry Bugbee, was asked by Martin Heidegger, what is it that begins philosophy? When, you know, what's the occasion that prompts it? And Bugbee, who lived in Montana and was a fly fisherman himself, said, could the sound of a trout rising to a fly suffice? The surprising events that happen when we're outside, if we allow ourselves to become their students, really can teach us a tremendous amount. I now teach an ecology course with Craig Spencer, a biology professor at Augustana, down in Guatemala and Belize every year as well. We take our students down there for January. And certainly my attention to streams in the Appalachians has changed the way that I look at the rainforest and look at the reef. But yeah, it has me out in my backyard paying close attention. I walk around with a hand lens a lot and just try to sneak up on dragonflies so I can look at the structure of their wings. I'm fascinated by what grows around me. Scott Russell Sanders has a book in which he says, he reminds us that in Genesis, God had Noah build an ark that wasn't just big enough for his family, but for every other species as well, as though every species mattered to God. Sometimes it's hard to imagine mosquitoes mattering to God, but I like to think that every species out there really does matter for us.
Now, you live in South Dakota now, as you mentioned. How much do you have the opportunity to fish here, lake fishing, ice fishing, that sort of thing? Does that interest you, too?
Absolutely, yeah. It's not the same feeling as when I'm in the Appalachians, just because I was born there. And, you know, as many people have said, the most beautiful place in the world is wherever you grew up. Every opportunity that I get to go out ice fishing or go out trolling for walleye or whatever. I think, again, these are ways of getting to know the land that I live in. I just love to walk in our parks here, you know, that new park near Sioux Falls, Good Earth. I love to walk out in the Black Hills, walk the prairie, anywhere. As I mentioned in the book, sometimes when I'm out pheasant hunting or duck hunting, one of my favorite things to do is just to lie face down on the grass and part the grass and look and see what's growing down at ground level, see what invertebrates are still walking around in October and that sort of thing.
Does that confuse your hunting partners?
I usually try to explain it to them first so that they don't worry about having to administer CPR or something like that.
No,
but you know, I'm a philosophy professor, so they don't expect much from
me.
You know? he's quirky. Yeah. You know?
Now the book Downstream, Reflections on Brook Trout, Fly Fishing in the Waters of Appalachia, some of what we were just talking about, this book then, even though it's about a particular place, a certain type of fishing, but this your intention here for the reader is to take this and translate it to other aspects of life.
Yeah. One of my favorite writers, Kathleen Dean Moore, who's an environmental philosopher at Oregon State, has this great line in one of her books. She says, "Sometimes the most loving thing that we can say to another person is, look." And, you know, if you think about it, that little kids are saying that to us all the time. Sometimes that's the way little kids are saying to us, I love you. They're saying, look. And I know brook trout, and I know the waters of Appalachia. There's more for me to learn, but this is something I've spent a lot of time in. And so because I know it, I want to say to the people around me, look. But I think an important part of that is also then asking other people, what do you want me to look at? So, I hope that this won't just be a book for people who already love fly fishing, but for people who want to learn to look and want to learn to love the place that they are, wherever it is.
Well, it sounds like you're open to having people show you that not just people here say look, but also people to you write about a guide in Tennessee, you and your co-author Matthew Dickerson, introducing you to a whole new world and a new way of fishing.
Oh yeah, he was fantastic. The method you're talking about is sort of a slingshot fishing. We were looking for the brook trout that might have survived the deforestation of eastern Tennessee about a century ago. So he took us way up into the mountains. He thought we were crazy to go up there because the fish up there are tiny and the streams are tiny too. And the streams are covered over with branches. Only way you can get in the stream is to crawl on your belly, hands and knees. I mean, you're soaked from head to foot. And there's, fly casting requires quite a lot of space. So I looked at it and said, Mark, how on earth am I supposed to cast here? And he just smiled at me and he said, let me show you. And he got down on his belly and he took my rod and he pulled the fly back and pointed the rod where he wanted the fly to go. And then he let go. And it was like a slingshot. The fly just ran right up the rod. And he gave me this very, very happy look like, you silly Yankees. You have so much to learn from us. He was great. We learned a lot from him.
Now, going back to the nature of children and look and that sort of thing, you write about when you're in sixth grade again, you and your friend just going off and exploring, and that you still have that. But I'm wondering for those of us who maybe have lost some of that childlike wonder in the natural world, how can we recapture that? How do we get that back? Or is it just you have to just keep your mind open?
Yeah, and part of it is that you have to be willing to be a little bit silly sometimes. I think that's part of how we outgrow our wonder is, when you're little, everyone expects you to be amazed at everything. And the older that we get, the more serious we're supposed to be, the more serious about our career and our lives and our finances and that sort of thing. As I said, one of the things that I do is I carry a hand lens with me just about everywhere I go, so that I can look a little bit more closely. Lenses are a real gift, cameras and hand lenses, because we can use them to kind of constrain our gaze and just look a little more closely at a bug, at a spider's web, at the grain of wood. And don't be afraid to stare at the sky. I make my ancient philosophy students go outside. They have to spend 4 hours outside on their back staring at the sky this semester. And they ask me why, and I say, because it's wonderful to stare at the sky. I'm your professor, and I can work that into the syllabus, so that's what you're going to do. I'll make you write about it, I think we just need to allow ourselves to slow down and do things that others might regard as a little bit silly while we look at the wonderful, beautiful world around us.
David O'Hara teaches philosophy at Augustana College in Sioux Falls. He and Middlebury College professor Matthew Dickerson are authors of the new book, Downstream, Reflections on Brook Trout, Fly Fishing, and the Waters of Appalachia. And Dave, I know you have a class to get to, but I want to thank you
I
so much.
I should probably go, yeah.
I want to thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us on Dakota Midday. And congratulations on the book.
Thank you, Carl. It's an honor.